So my question to Ray is there any reason you believe that Bridgewater should benefit from open source tools while society should suffer under closed source fiat currency? Shouldn't citizens everywhere have access to the most open and highest quality feature set for the most important tool in their lives, money? I don't know how you can reconcile these two things, and that's why I really wanted to point this array.
What's going on, my fellow Bitcoiners? I'm John Chenault, and welcome to episode 14 of the Bitcoin Path podcast. This is a show where we have deeper conversations about Bitcoin and self-sovereignty, about how this new magic internet money is changing the world and changing ourselves at the same time. In this episode, I'm excited to share with you session number 6 of the Cosmic Deep Dive with Robert Breedlove. This was an interactive event that took place December 12th and the 13th of 2020, and it was an amazing experience of growth and deep collaborative discussion. Be sure to keep an eye out for more events like this one coming up at thebitcoinpath.com. For those of you who are not familiar with Robert Breedlove, he is the founder and CEO of Parallax Digital and has authored many spectacular articles about Bitcoin from a deeper philosophical perspective. In this talk, Robert continues his elaboration of his article that he called An Open Letter to Ray Dalio Regarding Bitcoin. He opened up the first part of this article in another podcast with Pomp, Anthony Pompliano, earlier last spring of 2020. And I highly recommend you go and listen to that one. Robert and his work was truly a major inspiration for me in starting to work on thebitcoinpath.com. So it was an honor and a privilege to have him on. And with that, let's dive into this episode.
Into the colossal firm that it is today. And Ray also has been pretty instrumental in a lot of people's thinking about macroeconomics, including myself. He has a knack for distilling complex economic concepts into an easy to understand form. He's a really interesting guy. He's been a lifelong meditator, for instance. So he's got sort of a unique macro perspective that's not so clouded in jargon and confusion as you tend to get from a lot of other macroeconomic thinkers, that I've found to be just a way to almost try and justify their, almost like they're puffing up their chest when they try to use certain jargon or vernacular. And this isn't just in macroeconomics or hedge fund world. This is in other industries. You'll commonly see people sort of doing this soft flex by using certain words or terms to appear that, in my opinion, to project the appearance that they have an informational asymmetry or advantage over others to sort of justify their professional existence. And I really admired Ray that he dispensed with all that bullshit and just gets down to the bare bones and essentials of what macroeconomics is. And he's helped a lot of people gain a deeper understanding of an area that's typically considered highly complex. So with that, I wrote this piece back in November. It goes through, Ray wrote a book called Principles, and he laid out his personal principles of life and work in his book, and just described them. And what I found in reading this book is not only was it an eye-opener in a lot of ways, but at the same time I was reading his book, I was tumbling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And I knew Ray was he's very bullish on gold as a macroeconomic hedge against central bank market manipulations. He's done deep historical studies of it, and he's published a number of great works. He publishes them all for free on, I think, his LinkedIn page mostly. And the thing that kept occurring to me was, here's this really deep thinker. He understands mostly the monetary fundamentals of gold. He puts a lot of value on it amid the the greatest expression of central bank market manipulation we've ever been in, which is this, you know, 50 years into this global fiat currency experiment. But for whatever reason, he didn't grok Bitcoin. He didn't understand Bitcoin. He was actually, all of his public commentary on Bitcoin was negative, derogatory, and mostly ill-informed too. He was just throwing out the classic, it's too volatile to do anything fun. So I decided to write this letter. I titled it Open Letter to Ray Dalio regarding Bitcoin. I explain Bitcoin through some of the principles Ray lays out that componentize his worldview in his book. And that it was a very long read. I didn't get to all of his principles. He probably has, I don't know, 50 or more in the book. I think I touched on a little over a dozen. I also went on the Pomp podcast in February of 2020 to cover the first few principles. And that ended up being a huge success. That's got about 250,000 views on YouTube. I think it's got over 1 million downloads in the podcast version. And a lot of people, more than any podcast, until my most recent one with Preston, that podcast is, people have contacted me more about that podcast than anything else. So I thought what I'd do today is go through some of those principles. With Pomp, we only touched on the first few. So I thought I'd kind of cover the first few to set the stage and then go into the rest of them. I don't know how much time this is going to take, but we've got right around 12 principles to go through. So I thought I'd start going through them. And at the conclusion of each principle, I could take questions. If anyone wants to, you could chime in whenever, but I figured there'd be kind of a natural breakpoint at each principle. And then if we're running out of time, maybe I'll just fast forward over some of them in the middle and we'll get closer to the end that way. So with that, I will start.
Yeah, as far as time constraints too, I'm totally cool to go further. People obviously, if they have commitments, might drop out near the end, but it's totally up to you how long you want to go.
Okay, cool. All right, well, let's get started then. So everything we say, do, or make in the world, it begins as an idea. And the purpose of the world economy itself is to generate and share useful ideas through trade. And as we trade, our ideas become better. They give everything we say, do, or make more specialized qualities that are better able to satisfy wants. That's the purpose of the economy, is to satisfy the wants of market participants. And in trade, everything we're trading is valued at some ratio of everything else. So this car might be worth 132 chairs, or this house might be worth 11 cars. But instead of expressing exchange ratios in this way, we denominate them in money, right? Money is the medium through which we more easily calculate these exchange ratios in price. And like any other tool in the world, money is simply designed to save us time. Generating time savings, you could also say cost savings, time is cost, they're interchangeable more or less. Generating time or cost savings is the purpose of all tools. For instance, we can dig more holes per hour using a shovel than we can with our bare hands. And money is a tool that helps us negotiate and execute trades more quickly. So instead of having to deal with this myriad exchange ratios, we can just focus on the number, right? We can all orient ourselves to the number, which is the price. And it's also the medium through which economic actors communicate their preferences, which influences human action. So when we choose to buy a car or sell a house, the economy is responding dynamically by producing more cars and less houses. And contrary to common popular misconception, money is not a government creation. Money arises naturally in any trading society as simply the most tradable thing. Originally, this used to be just favors, right? People just, this very simple IOU. But as societies start to scale up, it becomes more and more difficult to keep track of these favors. So other forms of money emerged. As people seek to satisfy their wants through trade, they're steadily seeking to trade their things for more tradable things with the aim of obtaining the thing they ultimately desire, right? An asset with greater liquidity is by definition of more value to you as you're trying to trade towards, if you're trying to trade A for C, if B has more liquidity, you always prefer B over A because it helps you get closer to obtaining C. So in this iterative process, something naturally becomes the most tradable asset in a society. And whether that's salt, cattle, or gold, this most tradable thing is money. It's not a government creation. It's a free market phenomenon. And as societies advance, they coalesce around precious metals as money because they best satisfy the five properties of money, which, as I hit on in all my pieces, divisibility, durability, recognizability, portability, scarcity. Gold, which was the most scarce monetary metal, meaning it was the most, its supply is the most inflation resistant, came to dominate the world for that very reason. People could park wealth in gold, and they knew that its supply was the least manipulable. So it was the most trustworthy store value. But glossing over a lot of history, as we most of us probably know in the Bitcoin space, governments co-opted gold over time and they built a pyramid scheme around it called fiat currency. A pyramid scheme, by definition, is a business structure in which higher tier businesses steal value from those lower down. So you can think of it as like a system of network marketing, where early entrants or higher layer participants are actually extracting value from those lower down. They're extracting rents from later entrants into the scheme. And fiat currency is a pyramid scheme with central banks at the top that are hoarding the only real money, which was gold, free market selected money. And they generate profits by making loans to successive layers of banks below them, with each layer profiting from the loans it makes to subsequent layers. So all the interest revenues rolling up effectively. And it's a leverage-based business because all fiat currency is debt-based, right? Gold's the only equity-based money. All which were once claims on it, paper-based currencies were once claims on gold, but after 1971, they're not. They're just irredeemable debt certificates. As a leverage-based business, it requires more and more debt accumulation to remain sustainable. And it inevitably, all fiat currencies inevitably break down when that debt burden that it creates becomes unserviceable. So once it's tapped the productive economy of its ability to service existing and future debt creation, it collapses. And that's what hyperinflation is. And when governments took over the market for money, it was no longer a free market, right? Gold was a free market phenomenon, but fiat currency is not. It's an unfree market phenomenon. And that's important because the free market gives us a natural organizing principle or incentive scheme that encourages us to find better ways of saying, doing, and making things, to make better ideas. So we can think of the free market as all of our consciousnesses wired together by the price signal and as a forum for free exchange, we're incentivized to create better ideas. We're incentivized to generate and sell more useful ideas into society, to give the market what it wants. And we do that by making bets with one another, right? We're making investments of time, energy, and capital on a specific want satisfaction model that we think the market will demand at the exclusion of others. And if we're right, we are rewarded, and so is the market. Market gets an innovation, we get profits. And the gains accrete to society in the form of better or faster, cheaper ways of saying, doing, and making things. So all of these cost efficiencies and time efficiencies accrete to society. You can think of them as collective learnings that the market's generating, and society is encapsulating, right, in methods, tools, technologies, innovations. Another way to say that is that productivity gains, economic productivity gains, come from more specialized ideas, which come from trade. And I wrote about this in our most brilliant idea, actually, is that trade is the source of all our best ideas. It's like a meta idea. It's how we create more specialized ideas is through trade. So to connect this back to Ray, it's very bit of a first principles foundation there. The pinnacle of Ray's worldview is what's called the idea meritocracy. And the point I'm making here is that free markets are idea meritocracies. And we'll dive into more what an idea meritocracy is here shortly. The free markets are unhampered trade networks that encourage the cultivation and the diffusion of the best ideas, right? It's how we get better, smarter, faster, stronger, all that. All regulations and limitations on these free market dynamics, they reduce the efficacy of the free market. So they're constricting this this residue that the free market is throwing off, this in terms of productivity gains and innovation. Any decree or law or restriction to free trade is actually inhibiting that natural function of the free market, which is very important to understand. And the ultimate expression of regulation is a monopoly in which all free market competition is suppressed through coercion or violence. And in the world today, the market for money is not free, as we said. It's forcibly dominated by banking cartels. And these cartels are running fiat currency pyramid schemes, right? And these monopolies, they come at a very heavy cost to society. They increase prices, we all see that through inflation. They decrease innovation. Just look at any industry closer to the state or close with more dependency on the fiat currency spigot, and you'll see lack of innovation. And they reduce trade, right? We've been reduced to this system of partial barter at an international scale, where you have to switch into and out of different currencies just to execute geopolitical free trade. And this is really bad. If you've just taken economics 101, this is bad. Free markets are this form of free exchange that make mankind collectively more productive. Monopolies or unfree markets are making mankind less productive. So what free markets are economic, monopolies are anti-economic. So again, if an economy is meant to generate more useful ideas to improve quality of living for everyone, right? Once we figure out a refrigerator, we all have refrigerators for the rest of time, and it's really good. And if you haven't thought about the miracle that is your refrigerator lately, I suggest you do that. The fact that you can put food in that thing and it lasts for months, years, if you put it in your freezer, is a effing miracle. Okay, that miracle came from the free market. Monopolies and unfree markets suppress that idea generation function of free markets. So really important to understand how bad this is for society. So with all that background in mind, let's talk about Ray Dalio. I talked about this earlier, most successful hedge fund manager in history. I think he's got about $160 billion AUM. The cultural paradigm he incepted at Bridgewater, which is his firm, it's called the idea meritocracy. And in the idea meritocratic culture, the entire point is for ideas, the best ideas, to come to the surface of the organizational decision-making layer so that they could make the best investment and organizational decisions. So he's trying to get away from the traditional political hierarchy where you make your boss look good, he makes his boss look good, and then, you know, the net outcome of that political game is hopefully some good business decision making. He's trying to flatten that hierarchy and create an environment that's conducive to the free flow of ideas. And this has been very successful for him, clearly. And in that idea of meritocratic culture, candid reviews of colleagues are encouraged. So in Ray's book, he even shares a memo where a subordinate shared, like, graded Ray. So this was a, you know, an intern, let's say, wrote a memo to the company giving Ray a D for his performance in a meeting. Like an A through F grade, he got a D. And that's their style, right? You can grade anyone. It's all out in the open. They open source their meetings. They record everything. They're grading each other in real time using these certain types of customized management tools. It's an open source organization in a way. And this cultural style, promotes the propagation of truth by minimizing politics, right? We're minimizing, just like it's the same dynamics as the free market, by minimizing these artificial political barriers to the flow of information, we're maximizing the truth-finding function of the organization. So they can get an accurate depiction of reality by maximizing the flow of information. It's the same thing a market does. So I took that style, that idea of meritocratic style, and I wrote a memo to Ray assessing his evaluation of Bitcoin. And I gave Ray an F for his assessment of Bitcoin. And he laid out 3 points that I walked through and I think debunked. So, and there's a video, if you check out the piece, there's the video of him stating his position on Bitcoin. And his first point is that Ray says he's sold on blockchain technology, but not Bitcoin. Classic FUD. Despite Bitcoin being the only market-proven use case for a blockchain. Flat out. Inarguable, essentially. You could argue that some of these altcoins or shitcoins have had some marginal utility, but none of it has been as sustainable or consistent as Bitcoin. And most of them have unsolved computer science issues, and they're all subject to political machination, whereas Bitcoin's proven itself highly resistant to political forces. So I argue that blockchain's an unproven buzzword. Bitcoin is a momentous monetary innovation. So Ray's first point doesn't make any sense. Another analogy there is, like, it's almost as if he's saying the internet has no hope, but intranets are a great idea. Right? He's thinking wrong. He's not seeing the whole picture of what the internet is. The value is in the liquidity, the ossification of the protocols, the resistance to political manipulation, the permissionlessness. All of these things that Bitcoin offers us, similar to what the internet offers us, are not offered by altcoins or blockchain technology. So, secondly, Ray's second critique of Bitcoin is that he believes Bitcoin could be disrupted by any other cryptocurrency, and he cites iPhone disrupting BlackBerry as his comparative example. And this is extremely unlikely. This is something I argued about in depth in my piece, The Number Zero on Bitcoin. But in a nutshell, Bitcoin is a path-dependent, one-time invention, and its critical breakthrough is the discovery of absolute scarcity for money. We've never had any asset that's absolutely scarce. And as I lay out in The Number Zero on Bitcoin, you can only create absolutely scarce money once. And any other competing money with it is very likely, as we saw with Bitcoin Cash, we're just going to collapse into it. So I'll gloss over that. I could go into detail on that point, but it's a bit more drawn out. And I would just say, just go read The Number Zero on Bitcoin or check out a podcast about it. I've talked about it a lot. And we're just going to scroll to Ray's third point. So Ray's third point is that he says that price stable central bank or corporate-issued cryptocurrencies like Libra are a better alternative to Bitcoin because Bitcoin's too volatile to be a medium of exchange. Classic 2014 FUD. And partially true, because central banks are already announcing their attempts to launch CBDCs, central bank digital currencies. However, the one thing we can be certain of is that they will never surrender control over monetary policy. There is no central bank in existence that will ever forfeit control over the money supply. To control the money supply is to control the world. It is the entire reason for the existence of the central bank. It is the means by which they enrich themselves at the detriment of everyone else that's forced to use money. What the entire purpose of the organization will never be forfeited, okay? So that's, it just would never happen. Which that confiscation via inflation goes by a lot of names: Cantillon effect, confiscation via inflation, the shadow tax, taxation without representation. They're all theft, right? The central bank exists to steal from others. You can call it wealth redistribution. You can call it whatever you want, but it is a unilateral, involuntary exchange of value from a group that controls the money supply to the group that controls the money supply, away from those forced to use the money, legally compelled, and in some cases violently compelled to use the money, to use the fiat currency. Since Bitcoin has an absolutely scarce money supply, which is a monetary policy akin to absolute zero, it will continue to appreciate on an exchange ratio basis against fiat currencies, which are inevitably printed into worthlessness over time. Governments are the biggest debtor in the world. Inflation favors debtors. They will never stop printing money to erode their real debt burden. They will never stop printing money to steal from society to pay their bills. So long as they continue to print money, Bitcoin's absolutely scarce monetary policy will ensure that it continues to appreciate in terms of all other fiat currencies. And no one can do anything about that. No one can stop that. And to argue that Bitcoin's too volatile is to be ignorant of market dynamics. Exchange ratio or price volatility is a normal consequence of price discovery. You could consider Amazon, which crashed 94% from $85 to $5 beginning in 1999, and has grown over 40,000% since. Right, a hyper-volatile asset. And Amazon accomplished this historic feat. This is one of the fastest growing stocks in history, by gaining control of the digital market for distribution networks. The space that Amazon conquered is also driven by scarcity in the form of the finite distribution channels available to be digitized, and is also subject to winner-take-all dynamics because there's huge economies of scale that accrete to a monopolist in this space. And this would be a natural monopoly versus a legal monopoly, by the way. Amazon just established a network effect in the digital domain. There was no law that said Amazon was going to be the world's digital distribution company. So, similar to the market for money, which is also driven by scarcity and subject to winner-take-all dynamics, Bitcoin's following a similar path. And it's a path we saw that's similar to gold. And it's the reason we ended up with one analog gold. And in fact, Bitcoin is monetizing along the same path as gold. Today, being used as a store of value, once it's accrued enough value, it incentivizes those to whom the value has accrued to use it as a medium of exchange so they can actually trade their unrealized gains for stuff. And then finally, once it's used widely enough as a medium of exchange, it's natural that we begin to denominate prices in it more commonly, which leads to its last evolutionary phase to become a unit of account. So, those are my three specific responses to Ray's critiques on Bitcoin. And then, as I said, after reading his book, and I realized that so many of the principles he espoused positively embodied Bitcoin, I decided I had to write this letter. I couldn't stop thinking about it, so I had to write it. And that brings us to Ray's first principle, which is the idea of meritocracy. And as we go through these principles, I'll read a couple of quotes from Ray from his book to just help you get an idea of his thinking. So as Ray says, quote, idea meritocratic decision-making is better than traditional autocratic or democratic decision-making in almost all cases, unquote. So an idea meritocracy, it is a cultural paradigm, one that Ray incepted, as I mentioned, and it's essentially just a free market for ideas. It's a way of subjecting ideas to a simulated form of natural selection. So instead of believing the ideas of the guy with the most tenure or the guy with the biggest desk, we're actually letting ideas compete freely based on their own merits, idea meritocracy, right? And it's kind of a Darwinism for ideas, if you will. And another way to say this is it's an open environment for the proliferation and combination of the best ideas, free from man-made impediments, such as ego, policy, and hierarchy. So it's an organizational, cultural model designed to get us out of our own way, right? To let our ideas compete so that our egos and whatnot don't have to, and you don't need as many policies, things like that. So I mentioned this earlier, but we'll cover it again. The team members at Bridgewater, they review one another's work in real time. They're grading people on scoreboards during the meetings, like plus one, minus one, all this. They're recording, assessing one another's attitude in real time. They're just constantly providing real-time feedback to one another. So they're trying to function as one cerebral unit instead of individual worker bees. And all of this is to, again, it's the idea meritocracy is intended to be impervious to politics. Clearly, nothing's perfect. We're all, politics are part of human nature. But it's intended, the ideal of the idea meritocracy is to be impervious to politics and aligned with reason. And we can see this in the real world too, how this plays out. So if you think about the more objectively measurable and traceable the outcome of a job is, the less political it is by nature, as competence is the primary determinant of who gets and keeps that job. So you could consider professional athletes, right? Points scored, blocks, goals, whatever their quantifiable metric is, that's what drives their compensation. There's very little, there's much less political swaying going into those compensation figures. It's contract based on performance. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, so you could say professional athletes live in a world of objective metrics. On the other end of the spectrum, we could look at politicians, which live in a world of totally subjective metrics, right? You can't even trace necessarily the cause, the outcomes they're creating. You can't even trace the causality back to the politician's decision-making. They're largely elected based on charisma and cunning. So very subjective domain, and clearly politics is as highly politicized of an environment as you can get. And so the point in all this is that since everything we say, do, or make starts out as an idea, the idea of meritocracy is a free market. That's what it is. They're the same thing. Free market, generating the best and most useful ideas. Idea of meritocracy, trying to do the same thing. They're the same thing. And markets are necessary to disseminate knowledge because knowledge has a localized dimension to it, meaning that every person is familiar with the circumstances specific to their place and time and industry. So we all have localized knowledge that the market doesn't. And as entrepreneurs acting on that knowledge and adapting to the unknown, we're reconfiguring our localized circumstances and feeding information back into the market through our trade decisions. And in that way, free markets are the best assimilators and disseminators of the localized pools of knowledge into the broader economy, right? This is the classic price signal propagation. And in that way, a free market is a nexus in which many minds become one through the mechanism of price. You don't need to know that a fire burned down a banana plantation to know that you need to eat less bananas when the price of bananas goes up. That's all you need to know is the price. You don't need any of the other backstory, right? We're all dynamically adjusting to the nature of reality of supply and demand based on the price. It's a supercomputer, right? We are a supercomputer in the free market. It's a human supercomputer. And so free market capitalism, it's directed by the collective decisions of all economic actors, whereas central planning attempts to override the collective intelligence of the free market by installing a centralized bureaucracy, a group of people that claim or implicitly claim to have more intelligence than the collective intelligence of humanity. So it's just it's a non-starter. It's just bullshit, frankly. And that way we can think of socialism as a top-down, unnatural, despotic form of organization, which is like a traditional org chart, whereas capitalism is bottom-up, natural, and democratic, which is much more like the idea of meritocratic organization. It's a flat hierarchy, flat and adaptive. So the elephant in the room is, in light of the overwhelming evidence favoring free market systems, why do we still tolerate central planning in the largest market of all, the market for money? And to understand this idea a little more clearly and through the lens of Ray's worldview, a set of formulas will help us out. So Ray creates a formula in the book for the idea of meritocracy. And it's a composite of three other principles in his book. He says the idea of meritocracy equals radical truth plus radical transparency plus believability weighted decision making. Which is a correlate to a free market formula. We could say that free markets equal truthful price signals plus transparent and reliable rule of law, private property rights, and honest money. These are the tenets of capitalism. Plus skin in the game weighted decision making. And with those formulas in mind, we'll dive into their elements and their relationships with markets, money, and Bitcoin. And the first formulaic element of Ray's idea of meritocracy is the principle of radical truth. So, it's 45 minutes in. I can pause here to take any questions. And I would also consider maybe skipping ahead to some of the other principles I didn't cover in the past, because I don't think I'm going to get through all of them today. So I could open the floor for questions if anyone has any.
Hey, Robert, this is Ian. I guess one part one is a statement. I guess a year after you wrote the open letter, you have to take at least some amusement that Ray's tone seems to be changing slightly most recently. I don't know, you don't need that approval, yeah. But it's kind of to see nonetheless. I mean, your discussion just now brings up a thought, like other than Bitcoin, which I think, you know, from any rational assessment clearly wins the idea competition for money. Like, what are the other vectors you see as kind of driving society toward an idea of merit? Like, what are the other pivotal idea battlegrounds that get us there quicker? Is it capitalism versus socialism? You know, it just strikes me that like what we have today, if you were to somehow plot that on a, you know, time series, it's got, I mean, you know, such little in society is what you could even conceivably call an idea meritocracy. I'm just curious to know kind of what are those other pivotal idea battlegrounds for you?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I would say, let's paint a little context here, is that we're all really focused on Bitcoin, and Bitcoin is the central force in a broader movement, I think, I like to think of it as a digital renaissance that digital technology is radically reshaping our lives very quickly. And a lot of people talk about this. Always got to bring it up. This book, Transition to the Information Age, place that with digital age. This is the best deep dive, I think, best guidebook for what we're going into right now. But at a high level, we have never had this level of interconnection before, right? And if you think, I forget the scientist who said it, but the computer is the network. So the more interconnected this system of informational exchange is, the more intelligent the collective becomes. This is true in your brain, right? If you have more synapse connections, you have a higher IQ, typically. This is also true in an economy. The more quickly and the more fluid information flows, the more rapid the economy can adapt to change and discover price and uncover innovation. So I like to think of the digital age as this, the Renaissance aspect to it in my mind is it's like throwing gasoline on the fire that is the free market. We've had a good run with the free market, but now the institutions that we've built up to facilitate global trade at scale have become rather entrenched and politicized and corrupted. So it started to, it's created a huge economic boom. There's another book called The Rational Optimist on this. And if you look at the GDP per capita across history, it's like just a flat line forever until you hit the industrial age. And it goes absolutely exponential explosion. And all of that was based on, a handful of liberal economists that really drove home the point. You know, Adam Smith comes to mind, a lot of the Austrians as well, that the division of labor, comparative advantage, knowledge specialization, this is the way through which we advance civilization. And it's not just an advancement like once for now. These lessons are then encoded, right, into science, into heuristics, into tools that benefit us forever. And it gives us it creates even more efficiency and freedom for us to test our mettle against other challenges, to figure out other things. And that's the sequence to which we've been evolving. But that sequence now we've taken this system of moving ideas around the world that had to kind of be digested through politicized and corruptible institutions where they can get manipulated and frayed. And now it's being put into digital space where, you know, code is law, right? Like, it's very ruthlessly capitalistic. So you can't, and you see this in a number of domains. Like, we touched on Amazon earlier. It's like, no government wanted an Amazon. No government wanted a Facebook. No government wanted a Google. But what happened? They moved into a domain that they can move so fast that before they're already a multi-billion dollar company before government even knows what's going on. So we're seeing new forms of human organization. It's like just a Darwinian leap over old forms of human organization. And in that respect, I think Bitcoin is just this money that is purpose built for entrepreneurs, right? It maximizes accountability. It maximizes your ability to freely experiment and an adventure, if you will, in the free market by reducing all inhibitions to free trade. And the net outcome of that is that we're just going to have more free trade, which means we're going to have more wealth creation, more innovation. So that's the big theme, I think, it's hard to see it when you're up close, but whatever, 100, 200, 500 years looking back, I think we'll be, I say capitalism versus socialism, but in some ways I think Bitcoin causes us to rewrite the history books, because capitalism as we understand it today, it was never possible before Bitcoin in a pure sense, because money was always monopolized. So we always had one half communistic or socialistic economy everywhere, at least one half. By being unmonopolizable, Bitcoin gives us our first pure expression of capitalism, which we may just need a new word for, because the word capitalism has been so bastardized. I like the word sovereignism. So maybe we'll start trying to push that one into existence a little better. But yeah, I hope that answered the question.
The Rothschilds and the Pope are now coming out with the social capitalism, right?
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
No, I like that framing, Robert. That's great. Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
One thing that came to mind briefly as you were just talking was how, government did not want a Facebook or an Amazon or a Google necessarily, but it's almost as though due to the central banking structure and our reliance on that, the current monetary system, the way it works, they were able to co-opt them in a way that aligned their interests to the propagation of their own interests in their own entity. And so Bitcoin, I certainly hope, as I'm sure you do as well, will alter that incentive structure.
Yeah, I think the Libra case study is a great example, and that here's an organization much more capable of deploying a global currency or whatever, a multinational currency, than any central bank could ever hope to be, right? Facebook could run circles around every central bank for all the reasons we've outlined earlier. But because it's a political organization, it has a headquarters, it has a CEO, it has a tax ID, it's identifiable. Governments can apply pressure, right? And they've delayed Libra from launching. It's subject to all these different regulatory laws and modes of manipulation that Bitcoin simply transcends. So, I think Bitcoin is just something. That's why we're here today, right? It's a cosmic deep dive. It's something else. It's causing us to question all of these things. Like, there's a great old text on, it's called The Purpose of the Firm, or The Idea of the Firm, The Theory of the Firm, I think is what it's called. Calling all of these things into mind, like all the fundamental questions of what is a firm? What is a business? What is the nation state? It just is this, as I've called it, a first principles disruption to money. But when you disrupt money at first principles, money is the base layer, right? I said this the other day, a lot of people, the common misconception is government is the originator of money. That's not true. Money is the originator of government. Government formed once we had resources to safeguard, they became the protection racket that sat on top of those resources. And they inevitably wield that monopoly on violence to bend the resource allocation in their own favor. So, we're now disrupting money in a way that it can't be stolen, manipulated, changed. It just, the ripple effects cascade all the way up through everything we know. And that's why people are so scared of Bitcoin, I think. Maybe, I don't know that everyone understands how disruptive it is. But even if you're just someone on the outside looking in, I know in the US at least, there's people I know that have their identity tied up in the dollar. Like, yeah, the dollar's strong and we're strong and we're, rah! And it's like, Bitcoin just breaks that, you know. It's like scary to them because it's their identity. So anyways, may go off on a tangent there. Did anyone have any other questions? And are there any thoughts if I skip ahead to another principle? It'll be a little bit of discontinuity when I jump ahead, but I'll cover some fresh material. I won't have time to get through everything. So
that sounds good to me.
All right. So I will also make this PDF available which is kind of like a conversational form of the open letter to Ray Dalio. So whatever I'm skipping, you guys will have to go back and check out later. I'm going to skip radical truth, radical transparency, believability, weighted decision-making, because I covered those in the podcast with Pomp, and I'm going to jump to one we didn't touch on and start going there. So I'm going to skip ahead to the principle of open-mindedness. And Ray says, quote, if you can recognize that you have blind spots and open-mindedly consider the possibility that others might see something better than you, and that the threats and opportunities they are trying to point out really exist, you are more likely to make good decisions, unquote. Excuse me. So open-mindedness is a key aspect of both the idea of meritocracy and evolution. The concept is, it's closely related to filtering and optionality. So another way to think about it, even though it's called open-mindedness, it's a form of almost non-cognitive intelligence that's intrinsic to natural systems. So in which they're gaining exposure to multiple potentialities, and it allows the system to learn by adopting what works and discarding what doesn't. So for instance, in nature, there's a lot of redundancy built in, right? A lot of things work in parallel, like even you kind of have two eyes, two kidneys, a lot of these things. And when a natural system is growing, it's actually expanding itself in a way that it gets as much optionality as possible, but it can let some of those parts then, if its expansions become dispensable, right? It could let part of itself die to realize getting into new territory. So if you look at how like maybe a vine grows, it's going every different direction looking for sunlight, knowing that some of it's going to not find sunlight and probably wither and die. But it's just this open-minded impulse to kind of go every direction that actually helps it gain, it helps it grow, essentially. So, and when, like, for an entrepreneurial sense, when things aren't working out for an open-minded entrepreneur, they pivot, they adapt to the unknown, or what, they adapt to the changes. And for free markets, that those adaptations and those learnings, that's innovation, right? That someone hit a wall, they were on a course of action, they had a value destination going from A to B, they hit something they did not expect, they found a way to work around it. Others would encounter a similar problem, right? They basically figured out a way to solve this problem that other people will need to solve. They then have an incentive to sell that into the market, that solution. So that's what a free market is it's this open-minded exploratory impulse hitting against reality, working its way around it, and selling those solutions learned at the edges by entrepreneurs, selling them back into the market so that we all benefit from them. So the other end of the spectrum would be closed-mindedness, which represents a rigid fixity on an existing knowledge framework, and it excludes the possibility of learning, innovation, and evolution. And when you don't have a culture, if you're talking about an organizational culture, that lacks open-mindedness, it will fail to learn and adapt well. And it will begin to suffer losses at the hands of more fit competitors, right? Again, back to the digital age, what happened? So these competitors operating in digital space can do so at lower costs, right? No brick and mortar, at a higher scale, because they can move information super rapidly. And they can adapt super fast for those reasons. So they outcompete digital players, outcompete analog players in almost every industry. And we also gain some insight there on another perspective of the ineffectiveness of central planning. Central planning is like you make a plan and then you stick to this thing rigidly. This is the plan, we're going with it. Nature is dynamic. Nature does not adhere to your plans. Nature doesn't care about your plans. So when you move in line with a singular plan with a singular trajectory, it's a rigid plan of action. The economy or the organization adhering to that plan gets locked into this non-opportunistic course of action. It becomes blind to optionality, right? It doesn't have any other choices, just sticking to the plan. And thus, it is closed-minded. And eventually, it unravels, right? It diverges further and further from reality until it becomes so irrelevant that it just collapses under its own weight. That's what central planning is. That's why bureaucracies are so inefficient. They have no accountability to their P&L, right? They do not have skin in the game. So they're just stealing what they can from people via fiat currency inflation, funding their inefficient operations until the currency hyperinflates or collapses. Then they die. So you get these, and Taleb talks about this a lot, where you try and smooth over volatility in the short term. You're just exacerbating it and delaying it. So we can install a central bank to create low unemployment and price stability, right? Follow the plan. But we live in an entropic universe. Volatility is truth. It's still happening out there. So it's just accruing these hidden risks over time. So the plan diverges further and further from reality until something finally happens and cataclysm. Versus the free market constantly adapting to entropy, constantly learning and adapting. So you get little booms and busts, little booms and busts. But central plan, we get huge booms, massive busts. And so that, you know, closed-mindedness is fatal. And if you, this spans scale as well. If you don't believe me, go talk to someone and pretend like they don't have anything to offer. Pretend like that individual is not sovereign, not capable of making their own decisions. Put them in a bucket and be like, you label them something. You are this, and that's all you are. And if you interact with a person that way, they're going to get really mad at you. Right? You're discounting their sovereignty. There's something very deeply wrong with that. So you could do that in a personal relationship and see how it works. Now imagine how it works at scale when a central planner is discounting everyone's sovereignty and saying, fuck all of your decisions. This is what we're doing. You can imagine how it ends, right? It's very intuitive. And Richard Feynman has a great quote. He says, we can never be sure we're right. We can only be sure that we're wrong. And this is why open-mindedness matters across all spheres of human action. Or this also calls to mind the Taleb quote, right? You can see a million white swans, but you cannot prove that all swans are white. But seeing a single black swan proves that not all swans are white. So the moral of the story there is disconfirmation is more rigorous than confirmation. We learn via negativo. We don't learn by confirming things. We learn by disconfirming everything we can, and whatever's left is truth, basically. And that is, like, that's what science is. That's what the scientific method is, right? We investigate things, we form hypotheses, we try and disprove the hypothesis. If we can't disprove the damn hypothesis, then eventually it becomes part of the body of knowledge. So in the technological realm, this principle, this organic principle of open-mindedness is found in the form of open source technologies. Tools that have schematics that anyone can inspect, modify, fork, enhance. It's just a totally capitalistic open source software domain. And as I said earlier, Ray incorporates this principle into his culture of Bridgewater. The idea of meritocracy effectively is an open source organization. And these management tools they use to manage themselves, they open source those as well. He open sourced those to the market. So they created them in-house, but then they open source them. People iterated on them, added new features and feedback, and they reincorporated that learning. And so they're open source by design so that they can consistently adapt to their wants and their needs and offer the highest utility to raise workforce. So, and Ray has a good quote about this. He says, because thinking behind the algorithm is available to everyone, the thinking behind the algorithm is available to everyone, anyone can assess the quality of the logic and its fairness and have a hand in shaping it, unquote. So by applying the principle, and this is closely related to radical transparency, like you need radical transparency to have an open mind. You need to be able to see what your options are. By applying this principle of radical transparency to his management tool set, Ray encourages a culture of open-mindedness by making the tools open to critique and change in the same way that ideas are openly assessed based on their merits within the idea meritocracy. So again, tool and idea, they're the same thing. The tool is just the codified form of the idea. But when you codify it, that doesn't mean it's set in stone forever. It still needs, it needs to have some integrity so it's useful and persists across time, but it also needs an ability to adapt, right, to things that change. And so another way to connect this back to money is open source technology is valuable because it is trust minimized. And this is a Nick Szabo term that he used to refer to money. If you haven't read his work, you've got to. It's seminal to Bitcoin and money. Check out Shelling Out. All his work's really good. He's difficult to read, but worthwhile. So trust minimized means that the tool minimizes the need to trust people by maximizing trust in the tool through transparency, verifiability, and auditability. Openness lets it absorb feedback from many sources in response to changing market conditions and user demand. And trust minimization is also one of the primary benefits that made that ancient open source technology so valuable, gold, right? Gold was trust minimized money. Anyone could freely inspect it, see how its laws operate. You could inspect it to verify it. You could see across time that no one could change its supply. It was an open source tool, basically. Much less adaptive than what we consider open source tools today, but an ancient open source tool nonetheless. And since trading partners couldn't necessarily trust each other, right? Economics, you're competing. We're all cooperating, we're also competing, so the relationships are inherently antagonistic. Entrepreneurs could rely on the natural laws restricting the supply of gold and use time-honored techniques to verify its authenticity, which minimize the need to trust counterparties. Sorry about that. And at the other end of the spectrum, we have closed source technology, which requires trust in a third party, which, as Szabo says, third parties, trusted third parties are security holes, right? Because you're trusting people. People are sinful and corruptible. So you want to minimize the need to trust people to have the best tool in hand. That's the theme here. Closed source tech requires trust in the purveyor of the tech. They're often unauditable, and therefore they're maladapted to market conditions and user demand. In the case of fiat currency, the purveyor is a monopolist. And as many of us learned in Econ 101, profit maximization for a monopolist comes at the expense of everyone else. That's mathematically how it works. And monopolists, further, they're incentivized to maximize price, right? It's a parasitic relationship where they're incentivized to charge the maximum price that the productive customer base will support. So it's really bad. They're just sucking wealth out of the market. Basically, it's the opposite of a free market, as we covered earlier. Fiat currency is a closed source technology that is legally protected from audits and competing monetary technologies. And if you don't believe me, go start a business right now to compete with the US dollar and see how long it lasts. This opacity and market insulation not only slows the rate of innovation in the market for money, but it also erodes the trustworthiness of fiat currency and central bankers, the purveyors themselves. So again, Bridgewater, they operate in accordance with this open source ethos, that therefore they have an open-minded culture. And Ray, he has a quote about this too. It creates these systems that encourage others to, quote, put honest thoughts on the table, have thoughtful disagreements in which people are willing to shift their opinions as they learn, and have agreed upon ways of deciding disagreements if disagreements remain so that we can move beyond them without resentments, unquote. So Ray's approach to culture and management style mirrors the philosophy of open source technology. As I said earlier, it's an open source organization in many ways. So my question to Ray is there any reason you believe that Bridgewater should benefit from open source tools while society should suffer under closed source fiat currency? Shouldn't citizens everywhere have access to the most open and highest quality feature set for the most important tool in their lives, money? I don't know how you can reconcile these two things. And that's why I really wanted to point this at Ray and say, you are holding out this principle as one of your life and your work, and you've embedded it in your organization. Yet you either don't understand that fiat currency is antithetical to that, or you have an incoherent mental model on the world, the way I see it. Further, since Ray believes in gold, which as we said is an open source and free market money, how could Ray not believe in Bitcoin? Bitcoin is open source and it's free market money, and the market is speaking about its value. And at the very least, Ray is a proclaimed free market capitalist. He should be open to this idea of letting the market decide, right? We should all, if you truly have the humility of an actual free market entrepreneur, to understand that the market is by definition always more intelligent than you in the long run, then you should always adopt the humble position of listening to the market, being a student of the market. So all of the data paints Bitcoin as this best performing asset in history. It's had almost perfect uptime. It's never been hacked. We're now well over 300 billion market cap. Like where is the data from the market? Where is the signal from the market that's feeding, I'm asking Ray this question, that's feeding his criticism of Bitcoin? It doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't make sense for me, for someone to hold themselves out as this humble student of the market that listens and studies it deeply, but then to just write off this the loudest signal there's ever been from a market, the fastest growing asset in history. So it just seemed irreconcilable. And, you know, to go a little more deep on Bitcoin, is like Bitcoin is open source money, as we all know. That's why it's sometimes referred to as the Internet of Value. In the same way, the Internet is just, again, those stacked layers of open source protocols for moving information in a permissionless, trust minimized way. Bitcoin is a open source protocol for moving value. It's in many ways, you can consider it the latest layer in the Internet, right? Internet protocol suite. Application layer was at the high point. There's the link layer. Forgetting the other ones, I think it's four layers of these open source protocols, each one offering kind of a specialized function and communicating the layers below it. Bitcoin just snaps right on top of that thing. It's just another evolutionary layer of the Internet. To argue against Bitcoin is to argue against the Internet. It's crazy. It doesn't make any sense. And this openness, it's a competitive feature too for Bitcoin, just like it is for the Internet. It ensures that Bitcoin's code cannot be manipulated to benefit anyone at the expense of anyone else, which is the opposite of fiat currency, right? Fiat currency is this closed source code. We don't know how many units they're going to produce. We don't know how they're going to distribute them. We don't know what criteria they're using to make their decisions. We don't know when they're going to do it. We don't even know the shareholders. We don't know who profits from the money production. We don't even know the monopolist, actually. So it's like it's the opposite of Bitcoin. It's the opposite of open source technology. It's the opposite of open-mindedness. So central planners, at their own discretion and near zero cost, are just able to siphon value from the monetary network, from civilization, effectively, by inflating the supply of fiat. And you can think of this in a technological sense as a technology backdoor, right? Even the cash you stash under your mattress has a backdoor in it, hard-coded in it, that they can just print more units and siphon value away from you. Your money is not hidden. It's always exposed to counterparty risk in the form of this technology backdoor. Further, the institutional web surrounding central bank interest is so complicated and holistically unfathomable that it is extremely prone to politics, arbitrages by insiders, accumulation of systemic risk, and system-wide blowups. Just look at the history of central banking. It's been a fucking disaster. Everything they their express aims, they failed across the board, all of them, repeatedly. It's just, we are beyond anyone that has studied this. You have to be beyond patience at this point. We can no longer tolerate this failed organizational model for humanity. Free markets are lean and adaptive, whereas central banks are bloated and bureaucratic. This is the Darwinian difference between these two models. It's a convoluted institutional system that, as I like to say, is as clear as mud and is twice as dirty. That's what central banking is. It's hard to understand by design, and it's hard to understand by design because there's a bunch of dirty stuff going on beneath the surface. And speaking of dirt, that takes us to the next stop on our journey, which is the principle of faith in nature. So I can pause there and take any questions.
Happy to have anyone jump in here. One of the things that I was thinking about, Robert, as you were talking, is wondering if, I mean, we're focused a lot on Ray Dalio right now, but really Ray is very much a representation of a certain person or a certain ideology or a certain school of thought, so to speak. Right. Yeah. So that's really what's coming to mind is like, there's a blockage of belief with a lot of people where if something's confronting the very way that they've lived and done business for so long, that's a massive mental barrier to overcome. I imagine. So in a certain respect, I empathize with the guy because you have built a kingdom upon this game that is now becoming outdated. So I don't know. I just wanted to express that. Like,
no, I think it's an excellent point. The reason I chose Ray is because he is representative of this, let's call them the winners of the Cantillon effect, right? They played this fiat currency game to the hilt and succeeded wildly. You know, Ray's, he's a, as we covered, you know, he has a lot of, very much a deep thinker, very successful, competitive free market capitalist in a lot of ways, but he's also succeeded based on his proximity to the fiat currency spigot, right? A lot of these sovereign wealth funds, government clients, large institutions, they're all benefiting from this redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top. So Bitcoin, and yeah, you're right, Bitcoin emerged when Ray's in his 60s, I guess, mid-60s. Like, I mean, you guys all have old people in your life. Like, we become ossified over time. And if you've been playing one game for 40 years, you're going to have some blind spots. And Bitcoin is just something. But the thing about Ray, this is why the reason I picked him, was like, I feel like he could see the whole game board, right? Despite, it's like he even acknowledges that he's benefiting from this asymmetric system, but he's still calling it out, saying like, this is not right, it blows up, blah, 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 get into gold. He could see the whole game board, except he looked one level not deep enough beyond gold. Because if you read his writing, gold has been money because it has intrinsic value. That's where he stopped. He stopped at the second one layer too high, right? Intrinsic value doesn't exist. All value is subjective. Money's valued based on its the credibility of its monetary properties, which he's never read about, studied, something. He doesn't see it. He describes the functions of money, medium of exchange, storehold of wealth, as he calls it, and unit of account, right? Functions are second order properties. So he's never, that was this whole thing. Is like, this guy could see the whole game board. He does a great way of communicating it to the world, but he's missing this edge right here, which is principle one of gold, why gold was selected as money. He's blind to that, therefore he's missing Bitcoin. And yeah, I think the market is starting to sway him a bit. So.
Can I jump in?
Please.
Hey, Robert. Just to cut it short, so it would be like the banking system of Bitcoin. They are effective, but the difference is the efficiency then. So Bitcoin is more efficient then because it doesn't need so much energy and it's faster and the trust is out. So that's the difference then. It's like Amazon is more efficient than Walmart because they've got more products and more. So is that right?
That's absolutely correct. And one of the earlier principles that we skipped, I forget which one, but we actually go into that, that the functions of a central bank to maintain monetary policy, to facilitate value flows domestically and internationally, and to reconcile account balances, basically of banks or custodians. All of these functions are now provided by Bitcoin. So the army of bureaucrats, analysts, planners, politicians, I love this, my favorite example of this is, have you seen the macroeconomic analysts that are studying Janet Yellen's body language and the color of her blazer and her lapel? And did she blink twice? It's like, what are we doing? Well, there's a job for that. There's a job for one human to study another human's nonverbal cues to determine how much money is going to be in circulation next month. How insane is that? And then when you come to understand that the thing that escapes many people is that the quantity of money in circulation is a tool useful for only one thing. Yeah, thank you in the chat. That army of bureaucrats, central planners, analysts versus one Twitter bot auditing the Bitcoin supply, right? Or signing a message with your UTXOs, whatever it is. Bitcoin is an automated central bank, effectively. But it's a global decentral bank, right? And it's inverted the rules of central banking from opacity to transparency, from asymmetry to fairness. I think it will be regarded as one of the most wasteful institutions in history. To finish that last point, the quantity of money in circulation is just a tool for redistributing wealth. You cannot, the fallacy is that somehow providing liquidity to the market is infusing it with new capital or people or time or resources or ingenuity. It is a lie. It's not disputable. It's not arguable. You're taking paper claims on the collective savings of the world, and you're making one person's pile of paper claims larger and diluting the claims of others. Those that depend on fiat currency as a store of value, which are the most economically vulnerable among us. The poor, those living on fixed income, and retirees. They need that currency to hold its value. They're being victimized in this pyramid scheme. It's just totally wasteful. Totally wasteful in every sense. Any other questions? Comments? I guess I should look at the chat.
I think we're good to go for now.
Good to go. All right. So moving on to the principle of faith in nature. Where he says, quote, "Whenever I observe something in nature that I or mankind think is wrong, I assume that I'm wrong and try to figure out why what nature is doing makes sense," unquote. Similar to the mostly uncompromising rules governing gold, the rules governing Bitcoin are founded in the absolutely, uncompromising rules of mathematics. Mathematics is nature's fundamental language. In this natural sense, Bitcoin represents the fusion of our two universal languages, which are money and mathematics. Someone argued with me that music was the other fundamental universal language, and I do agree. So I guess Bitcoin doesn't have, it's got 2 out of 3, which ain't bad. And there's pretty good Bitcoin songs out there too. I think Newt, I can never say his last name right, Newt Svenholm, he did one recently that was really good. Anyways, that was just an aside. So as we've seen throughout history, gold is the king of natural money. And it arose to dominance as a result of free market processes, which themselves are operations of nature, right? This is voluntary exchange by sovereign individuals promoted gold to be the tool that best fulfilled the 5 properties of money. It's important to understand gold is natural money. Fiat currency, on the other hand, is artificial. It only exists in economies where people are coerced into using them via artifices like illegal tender laws, capital controls, confiscatory actions, and other anti-competitive restrictions in the market for money. So fiat currency exists only from compulsion. Gold exists because of freedom. Free markets are, as I argue, a natural organizing principle for humanity. It converts the pursuit of individual self-interest into improvement of the collective interest, right? By pursuing the profit motive and preserving private property rights, humanity learns how to better satisfy wants and then sells those learnings into the market for everyone to benefit from. And the free market is a spontaneous order that has persisted to a greater or lesser extent ever since mankind started trading, right? That's what it is. We're just freely figuring things out and trading with one another. Very simple. And they transmute, free markets transmute greed into higher productivity, lower prices, and a stream of new and useful innovations. So it's kind of this, again, if we're preserving the principles of natural law, right, which are at the bedrock of capitalism, which beneath that is a Judeo-Christian substructure even. The natural inborn rights to life, liberty, and property. We are transmuting greed, our sinfulness, into collective virtue in a way. We're creating the pursuit of our individual self-interest actually benefits the collective. So that's why it's such a genius system. It's to fight against liberty or free expression is to do a disservice to yourself and everyone, which is a bit paradoxical because it ends up being greed that actually causes these institutions to try and mute or manipulate free market dynamics, right? Instead of just letting gold be money, a bank decided, I'd like to have a little bit more of an edge on everyone else. So I'm going to squelch the free market dynamics, put in some laws that allow me to siphon wealth. But now they've introduced this pathology on the free market that actually dampens it over time and eventually causes the institution to collapse. So it's a self-defeating effort in the long run. And so my question there is, you know, what excuse is there for us to tolerate an unfree market for money? And as Ray said, quote, "Remember that most people will pretend to operate in your interest while operating in their own," unquote. This is exactly what the private owners of central banks have been doing successfully for over a century, operating their own self-interest under the aegis of government-enforced monopoly at the expense of everyone else. And under the moralistic camouflage, by the way, like a typical communist, of price stability and low unemployment. Just like the old Marxist credo, from each according to their ability to each according to their need. Sounds beautiful? It's bullshit. They lie to you. They put on a moral veil to lie and to steal from you. That's what it is. This is why it's important to think more than one layer deep, right? Never just think one layer deep. There's a great book on this called Economics in One Lesson. It talks about the seen and the unseen. If you just focus on the seen, you're going to be confused by reality forever. You must focus on the unseen principles that generate the seen. So in this sense, central banking could be the most successful con artistry at scale ever perpetrated. And deceptions like this, to Herman's earlier point, they're inherently energy inefficient. They require escalating enforcement and maintenance costs to scale. So if you are a tyrant imposing rules on a body, you have to expend resources to enforce compliance of those rules, and you also have to expend resources defending your turf from competitors that would like to milk your turf. Whereas in a voluntary game, where people are consensually adopting the rules that best favor them, and the emergent outcome of that is a dynamic stability, there are no enforcement costs. People are voluntarily adopting the rules, and you don't really have to protect the turf. You just have to preserve the principles of the market. So this voluntary game inherently outcompetes this involuntary game. If you want to go really deep on that topic, the genetic epistemologist Jean Piaget calls this an equilibriated game versus a disequilibriated game, that the equilibriated game always outcompetes the disequilibriated game. Another way to think about this, if you're in a household and the father is an alcoholic tyrant and he just beats his wife, tells his kids what to do, makes all these hard rules that everyone has to abide by, what do you think is going to happen to that household in the long run? You think anyone's ever going to abide by his rules, like with their whole heart and being? You don't think they're going to try to cut corners and stab him in the back every chance they get? You don't think that household is going to tear itself apart at some point because of this tyranny that this guy is imposing? That principle scales. Tyranny is not sustainable, right? Now, we've seen the central banking tyranny work out. It's failed many times over and over, but the current model has worked out for 100 years. That's a blip in human history. And it's failing right before our eyes. So this isn't just a moral crusade, like rah, rah, Bitcoin, it's better for people. It's like, it's very pragmatic. Fiat currency is going to fail. It is failing before our eyes. Where are you going to be? Where are you going to store your wealth? How are you going to protect yourself? How are you going to preserve your family's interests across time? In nature, energy efficiency is key. The first law of thermodynamics is the law of conservation of energy, right? This is truth. Energy conservation is truth. Life forms follow this law very lazily and very cleverly, by the way. Since energy cannot be created or destroyed, it is strictly finite, and life must make efficient use of it if it is to survive. And the entire purpose, as we covered earlier, of the world economy is to generate useful ideas, but these ideas are intended to increase our productivity. That's the measurement. That's what GDP is, right? We're measuring our aggregate productivity, which is another way of saying we're increasing our aggregate energy efficiency. That's what this whole thing is. Just like an organism trying to eat eucalyptus leaves slowly and lay around all day, we're trying to trade with one another to mobilize more resources with less effort. That's what the whole game is. It's energy efficiency. It's the first law of thermodynamics. And to point at Bitcoin, you know, the latest reports conclude that 74% of Bitcoin mining is energy sourced from renewables because they're the cheapest source of power, right? This is inbuilt to the Bitcoin incentive schema that, as I like to say, whereas the incentives related to fiat currency induce a race to the bottom in terms of currency valuation, right? We have different nation states competitively devaluing their currencies to acquire scarce assets. The race to the bottom in Bitcoin is to the cheapest energy. It's this global bounty program for underused and unused energy sources. So it's this perpetual reward for discovering new and better ways and cheaper ways to harness energy. So Bitcoin is like this accelerant to the core purpose of the global economy, which is energy efficiency, first law of thermodynamics. And in that way, we can just liken Bitcoin as a global bounty program. You know, let's go and find cheap and renewable energy, and you can now transmute it into digital gold. And that is a really big deal, because we now have a direct financial incentive for everyone, everywhere, forever, to uncover better ways of harnessing energy. Like with that, it's hard to understate how important that is. Right? It's something you could think about for a really long time. And in that way, Bitcoin may prove to be a catalyst for a renewable energy renaissance and could be the ultimate tool for economizing human action, right? Just accomplishing greater results with less efforts. Bitcoin is fundamental to that purpose. And on the other hand, we have fiat currency, a man-made tool for control. Although it's commonly held as, you know, the natural order of things in the modern world, it's precisely the opposite. And as Ray said, quote, "To be great, one can't compromise the uncompromisable," unquote. So what excuse is there to compromise the redeemability of dollars for gold, or to so heavily dilute the value of fiat currencies over time? What's the excuse? It's uncompromisable. To store the fruits of your labor, which is the outcome of the expenditure of your life force, energy, and action, it is a basic human right to be able to store that in a medium that cannot be compromised, or store it in whatever medium you want, frankly. Store it in whatever the fuck you want. That's what a free market is. But people learn over time to store it in a medium that cannot be compromised. So what excuse is there for using government compulsion to compromise that medium? It's as catastrophic as compromising freedom of speech. And these machinations by government are solely designed to enhance the expropriative abilities of bankers, bureaucrats, and politicians, which lets them, by the way, spend as much as they want and effectively default on their debts, pushing all the real cost of their present expenditure to future generations. Fiat currency is a tool of intergenerational dispossession. It allows people in the present to steal from those in the future. And far from being a natural form of money, fiat currency became dominant in the world at the end of a long chain of causality that we've touched on somewhat today. And that chain is rooted in a flawed system that incentivizes people to operate with smaller time horizons and a zero-sum mentality. This is the classic Austrian time preference, right? When money doesn't hold its value, you tend to think more short-term. You cannot be more civilized, more thinking big, if you will. Which brings us to our next principle, which is the principle of chains of cause and effect. And I can pause there and take any questions, comments, or feedback.
I think money doesn't hold any value, does it? That's Voltaire said. It just coordinates, I mean, it shifts value. So where is that idea coming from that money is holding value? Have you got an explanation for that? Because most of my friends...
Sorry to cut you off.
Friends think that money is value. So they hold it and they hold on to it. But that's not the case. I mean...
Well, the question becomes, what is value, right? And now this goes into a deep philosophical rabbit hole. Since we're on the cosmic deep dive, I'll recommend a book I'm reading currently that is already, I haven't finished it, but it's already in my top 10. It's by Robert Persig, who wrote Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. This is a book he wrote, I think, 15 or 20 years later, called Lila, L-I-L-A. And it's about the metaphysics of value, quality, and morality. Really interesting book. He posits, actually, that our materialist viewpoint is flawed, that actually value is fundamental in the universe, and that what we call materialism is just static value. So there's dynamic value and static value. I could go on for hours about this. I'm thinking about it a lot lately, but I would just say check out the book. If you do read it, please reach out to me. I'd love to talk about it, because I'm like, it's shaking, reshaping my worldview, and I'm looking for people to talk to it about. And we also have, I have this Patreon and Telegram group set up for my book, and we talk about crazy stuff like this all the time. So if you guys are interested, just reach out. I'll connect you. Value, I'll try to put a simplistic definition on it, is anything that is relevant in the course of goal-directed action. So, and, you know, this is Misesian first principles. If you've read the book Human Action, you'll come to see the world as, again, not materialist, but more as a realm of relevance, where we all have purpose and goals and aims, and the tools and impediments between us and our aims are dynamic. They're not any one thing. And the example I like to give here is this table, which is holding my laptop right now, is a tool to me. It has value to me in the course of my goal-directed action, which is delivering this message to you. If I instead, someone offered me 100 Bitcoin to jump over this table would become an obstacle to me, right? The table hasn't changed. The material, the fundamental material nature of the table hasn't changed, but its context in my sphere of relevance has. So it's gone from something that's valuable to me to something that's needs to get out of my way, right? The value is getting past it, if you will. So that's how I would define value, is we're all acting purposefully, aiming at something, going from A to B. Anything that accelerates us along that course is valuable. Anything that impedes us actually has negative value. Anything that's not relevant is valueless. That's how I define it. And I would say in that context, money has value if there is a sustainable trading economy, because money is a claim on the savings of that economy. It's a claim on the time of that economy. It can render you any good service or piece of knowledge that economy can generate. It gives you pure optionality on those savings of the economy. So we could get into this debate about, does money hold value or not? It's a claim on value. If part of your goal-directed action involves obtaining things that you cannot create yourself and you need to obtain from a trading economy, then I would argue that money does have value. Now, the value, if you grant me that money's holding value, the value storage, store value function of money is provided by the assurances of its supply scarcity, right? You want to know with the utmost certainty that the supply of that money is not prone to change. You want to also know that no central party can deauthorize the money or reverse a transaction. You want to be able to settle with finality. And you also want to know that your money's secure and resistant to confiscation or seizure. So these, all those aspects of money, I would argue that it does hold value. Now, if you go to the opposite end of the extreme and say, hey, I'm Robin Crusoe on a deserted island, I'm wrecked here and trying to survive, there's no one to trade with, you go back to the ship to get some stuff, you're not going to get the gold, because the gold, there's no one to trade with. There's no money in that economy. That economy of one, all of the things that become relevant to you are the coconuts, the axe, the knife, the flint, the things that help you survive. But in a trading economy, money has a lot of relevance. I hope that answered the question.
Thank you. Did. Cheers.
Any other questions, comments, concerns? Sorry, I got a runny nose today.
Robert, this is maybe a quick one, but just trying to kind of connect dots and build a, you know, ever better mental lattice work. Do you see a connection between like the faith in nature principle and some of like Ayn Rand's thinking and, you know, activism, where she sort of posits that human nature kind of necessitates certain systems of, you know, societal and economic, you know, inner relationships. I'm just curious if you've studied that at all.
I've got to be honest, and I'm disappointed to say this, that I actually haven't read The Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged. I've read parts of them both, but not the works in their entirety. So maybe I could answer that question a little better if you expanded upon it slightly.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth a read, in my opinion. The, you know, her, I was, while we were talking, I was just looking up some of Persig's, you know, kind of description of that. It sounds really interesting, but she's basically attempting to articulate a philosophy that kind of fully encompasses, it, right, you know, epistemology, metaphysics, and then ultimately morality and politics and economic systems, right? That's her, you know, that's objectivism. And her basic argument is that, you know, because I can't, you know, I can't think thoughts for you. Like I can't, you know, neurologically come in and, you know, make decisions for you. And furthermore, I think you even hit on this earlier, like, you know, you're not a plant that can just kind of sprout roots and photosynthesize and survive. And so, you know, as mankind, you know, you have to use your brain, your faculties to survive, and sort of taking that and extending it out to then say, well, you know, therefore, I mean, she basically uses that to then back into, you know, rights to property and pursuit of happiness, et cetera. And so, and then from that, she kind of flows into, okay, what would the, you know, what would a social system or economic system look like that kind of directly extends from that? I probably didn't do her justice, but that's
no, that's helpful. That's very helpful. So without, again, not having read her directly, I'll try to just maybe flail about a little bit and answer some of what I got from that. We can think of this as the interplay between the principles of static and dynamic. So kind of like what we talked about in open-mindedness, we need this dynamic quality. Nature needs this dynamic quality such that it can express this exploratory impulse, right? It can go into nature, confronting the entropy of the world, which, by the way, entropy is uncertainty, randomness, disorder. You can think about this as unexplored territory, right? In that sphere that we're describing of purpose-driven human action, we have things that we know, things that are encoded in our mental model, mental maps, and things beyond our horizons that are unexplored. And it's relative, right? My explored territory can be your unexplored, vice versa. You need the dynamic aspect of that to be exploratory, but then you also need the static aspect to encapsulate the learnings. So whatever you do venture out into the world and discover, you need to be able to codify that into something, you know, a word, a symbol, a recipe, a tool that you can then share with others. So we're capturing the essence of these dynamic lessons into a static container that's shareable and communicable amongst other people. And the sum total of these things, you know, we're entrepreneurs going out, facing the entropy of nature, learning through pain, basically, learning through failure, adapting to the unknown, bringing home the treasure of knowledge. The aggregate treasury of knowledge is society. That is human, that is the everything, right? That's our sum total of knowledge, how we orient ourselves, our culture, our everything, right? Our arts, all the things. If we lose that dynamic feature, then we become dominated by the static, right? Whatever lessons were learned in the past become oppressive almost. It's like you're born into the system. We're all born into the system today. We didn't really know how it got here. We're just woke up, we're alive, we grew up in it. I'm using technology, like how long did it take the laptop to emerge? Well, 100,000 years of human history, right? I'm using it, I'm 30 years old. I'm almost 35. Point is, the static needs to exist to maintain integrity and structure. It is the protocol through which we interact. It's another way to think about it, right? But if you lose the dynamic quality that it's learning at the edges, this static portion will become too rigid. It will become a tyranny, right? The old dominating the young, no new lessons learned, no new culture being refreshed and revivified. But if you lose the static element, then it's just disarray. You can't learn anything, right? We just go out and learn, bring things home, but we're not encapsulating it and coding it into any structure. So it just never gets, nothing sticks. It's almost like if you used a ratchet wrench where it's got the dynamic thing and then it clicks back. It's static when you go the other direction to exert force. It needs the dynamic and then the static, the dynamic and the static. So it's this ratcheting effect to build civilization. And I would argue that that edge piece, that dynamic piece, is freedom of speech, innocent until proven guilty, habeas corpus, like holding the sovereignty of the individual higher than the state. The presupposition that any one of us may learn something in our explorations or contentions with the entropy of nature that the rest of us need to know, that there is some, you want to talk about intrinsic value, there is some intrinsic value in the individual, in the logos, in our ability to perceive and problem solve, that society needs, it is the lifeblood of society. It only takes one of us to radically change all of us, right? Steve Jobs. We go down the list. There's a bunch of people, one guy that's just cracked the egg that's changed everything for us. You need that interplay, right? You need integral social structures that preserve the learnings from our exploratory behavior, but you also need to honor the explorers, the entrepreneurs. They are our leaders. They are our economic heroes. They're the ones venturing into the unknown. 95% of the time they're dying, right? They're going bankrupt, out of business, whatever. They're dealing with the chaos of nature. Almost every idea we have sucks. Like, we have to face that fact. We try, it's tinkering, right? You gotta try different things. 100 things don't work, all of a sudden you find penicillin, whatever it is, right? And all of a sudden the life expectancy of the world surges by 20 years. It's a crazy dynamic, but I may have gotten a little bit off on a tangent, but that's what I see. It's like you have to have respect for both sides. Another way to think about it is like liberal and conservatism, right? So you need both. You need both. But at the bottom of all that is that the individual is the elemental component of society, of the economy. And we must hold that divine value that they have, which is expressed in the logos, their creativity, their problem solving, their ingenuity. We have to hold that in highest regard. If we let society just oppress people, we're going to kill off our Steve Jobs. We're going to kill off people that advance us. And that's why Bitcoin is so profound, right? It maximizes individual sovereignty in a way that we've never before seen. So it gives you this, ideally, the promise of it at least. We don't know what a Bitcoin-denominated world looks like, but it gives us this rigidity and integrity of the protocol, the rule set through which we interoperate that can't be changed, right? It's 21 million, can't counterfeit it, can't confiscate it. Every 10 minutes, block, block, block. We know the monetary policy. It's just a fixed rule set, but it's amphibious in a way, right? It can still adapt to things, and it's maximizing the sovereignty of the entrepreneur to adapt the collective learnings of humanity. So that's why it's this radical new organizational model. I hope that hit on some points there and help explain how I see it.
Yeah, that's super interesting, Robert. I think you'd like her work. Like, you know, her kind of idea on knowledge is that we can know truth, so there is objectivity, but that it's sort of contextual based on sort of the summation of, you know, human knowledge at a given point in time, which I think kind of plays interestingly with that dynamic versus static idea. But yeah, no, I appreciate the recommendation for Persig stuff too. It looks pretty interesting.
Yeah, to speak to that, actually, truth, which I like to talk about a lot in my work, I think there's only one capital T truth, and I call that the truth beyond words. There's a reality beyond duality, beyond logic, beyond math, beyond language. That's what I would put in the domain of God, word that triggers people, but it's just a word to represent the truth beyond words. It's like, you have to understand that everything we're saying and doing, we're in a limited sphere. We can never expand that sphere to the totality of all that is. And if you don't, this isn't like even philosophical. So just look at quantum mechanics. Look at astrophysics. There are limits. There are epistemic limitations. Knowledge does break down at the surface of a black hole. It does break down below Planck length. If, you know, the world that we think is A causes B becomes a cloud of probabilities. So this is like, there's something way beyond everything we can perceive is the point. So we can't say anything about it because it's beyond language. So we call it God or universe or multiverse or the truth beyond words, right? So I'll say that about profound truth. Instrumental truth, which as I argue is what markets generate, right? We are competing and cooperating. And through these collisions of relationship, we're eliminating individual bias. Right? You have a certain slant on the world. I have a certain slant on the world. We're both a little bit wrong, but together we're a little more right. We've developed a more accurate portrayal of reality by smashing our ideas together, right? And discarding what's not useful, keeping what's useful. That's the American pragmatist definition of truth. Truth is the end of inquiry. So this constant process of inquiry, right? We are advancing instrumental truth in the form of innovation, new ways of doing things, new organizational models, new civilizational models. And you could kind of consider in that way that truth is indistinguishable from that which is useful in an instrumental sense, right? What's the truth of digging holes? It's a shovel, right? We've all been trying to dig holes for a long time, figure out the best way to do it. We've all smashed a bunch of ideas together, tried different entrepreneurial exploits and approaches. And what did we end up with? A shovel. There's a few different kinds of shovels, different price points. Great. The market figured all that out for us. Now we don't have to think about it. We have the truth of digging holes. Price, as they say in markets, is truth, right? It's the, what is the exchange value of this good service or knowledge in the real economy based on everyone's inputs? So it's, we're assimilating all of our intersubjective realities, these little spheres, these subjective spheres in which we operate. We're smashing them all together, putting them, contextualizing them against the objective scarcity of nature, the objective scarcity of resources. And we're generating a number, which is this shovel costs $20. Price is truth. Tools are truth. And in the last instrumental bucket, I argue, is virtue, right? The virtue we develop, honesty, integrity, forthrightness, these things, it's not like we just pick them because they feel good. I mean, maybe they do feel good in a way, like, but they're instrumental, they're useful. I think Val said this the other day, that when you tell a lie, you actually fork reality, right? But as Buddha said, three things you can't hide for long: sun, the moon, and the truth. That fork ultimately becomes an orphaned block at some point, and we go back to the main chain. We go back to reality. So lying, when individuals lie, it's again breaking the energy efficiency of the whole. So markets are generating and encouraging entrepreneurs in a free market to be virtuous. You're accountable to the preferences of your customers. If you don't satisfy them, if you don't service them satisfactorily, then you fail, right? And those characteristics get weeded out by natural selection and virtue remains. So that's it. I think truth is discovered, or maybe the capital T truth is more closely approached the more we develop instrumental truth, right? We're getting closer to capital T truth. We can never get there, but we're getting closer and closer to it. And one last way to think about that I think is really interesting. Innovation, as we touched on earlier, the purpose of all innovation is time savings to accomplish greater results in less time. So what are we doing? We're more closely approaching the eternal, that which is beyond time. We're becoming more timeless. We're lowering our time preference, and we're more closely approaching these eternal principles. Whatever is eternal, we don't know what it is, put whatever word you want there. There is something beyond space and time. We don't know for certain, but there are a lot of indications that there's a reality beyond space and time. Whatever is there, we come closer to through innovation. So that's it.
It's a lot of great nuggets there, Robert. This is well said.
Thanks, man.
100%. Robert, thanks so much. One of the things that it brings to mind, and you know, I'd love to hear, you know, some closing thoughts from you after this. We are at the 2 hour mark, but you know, I think this is, I'm sure you have much more to delve into, much more prepared. You know, it calls for another session, I'm sure, for you to delve into some of the other aspects of your letter to Ray Dalio that you'd like to address. But I'd love to hear your thoughts about how meaning comes into this. One of the things that you mentioned in the beginning, was like, you know, this idea of a meaningful life. And, the more you focus on that that you've experienced in your life, the more value you've been able to provide for other people as well. And I kind of see this very primary element of truth interacting with free individuals, or free individuals interacting with truth, or this relationship almost creating a meaningful existence. And I've kind of thought about the analogy of mycelium, or a living organism, is Bitcoin is a living organism, and Brandon Quidham, you know, a lot of his work about mycelium, and as well as the tree imagery in scripture, and you know, a lot of other mythological writings, where like I really see Bitcoin as this tree or living creature of meaning, where it's like it's helping people to develop meaning in their own life. So I know that's kind of like opening things up into another realm that I'm sure we could wrap for another 2 hours on. But
yeah. No, I like the question. Can I have 5 minute break, and I'll come back and give a much better answer to that?
For sure. Let's all take a 5 minute break.
Okay, cool.
And come right back. All right.
Okay. So, meaning. So one thing comes to mind. There's a book called The Eternal Golden Braid. Really hard book. I actually haven't quite finished it, but I read the majority of it. I don't know. You got to read the book. It's crazy. It's really good. But the mathematical concept underpinning meaning is called isomorphism, which, as I understand it, essentially means that if there when a pattern interacts with another pattern, and the new pattern can mold itself to the pattern interacting with it, it's absorbed its meaning, right? It's taken on the configuration of whatever the, and this gets into like, what is information? Information, we're talking about earlier, the sphere of intersubjective experience we all have, right? The limits of that sphere are the boundaries of explored territory for us, our own relative explored territory. This isn't just physical spatial territory, by the way. This is your knowledge, right? What words do you know? What equations? How do you write software? Anything known and unknown, right? Explored, unexplored territory. The boundary of that, inside the bound, is encoded knowledge, basically. Outside of that is entropy, it's uncertainty. Every time you resolve entropy and convert it into knowledge, that is information. So information is that unexplored territory filtering in through the bounds of your epistemic capacity into your own treasury of knowledge. That's what information is. So meaning is when information is coded in a pattern, and when that pattern interacts with another, that pattern which is interacted with reconfigures itself to map onto the pattern interacted with it. And this, you could also think about this way, like I got some Peterson. Information means to put something in formation. So the formation of pattern one influenced the formation of pattern two. So it changed the formation of it. So when something, we can establish a meaning relationship, that doesn't mean it matches it. It's not like it was this shape and now it's this shape. It just means that the elements in this pattern can be mapped to the elements in this pattern. So there's an isomorphic relationship between the two. That's the mathematical definition of meaning. And when you look at what's meaningful to you personally, Carl Jung talked about this, is, you know, he has a book called Synchronicity, which is the A-causal principle. So the principle beyond causality, he called synchronicity. So he was a firm believer that there is reality beyond space and time. And he thought that meaning was actually your future potential, if you will, whispering back to your present self. I know that sounds totally fucking crazy, but that's what he thought meaning was. And he thought that by listening to that potential, that you could actually, what he called, circumambulate yourself towards your highest future potential. I'm scarcely a student of Jung. You know, most of my knowledge about him is through Peterson. I think very interesting stuff. I don't know how to reconcile it with everything else at this point, but I can say personally that for me, pursuing a path that's meaningful to me has been painful. I think it subjects you to a lot of entropy, right? When you choose the road less traveled, so to speak. But I have no regrets about it ever. No matter what adversity has taken me through, I've always looked back and been grateful for the things I've learned along the way and appreciative of the person it helped me grow into. I don't know if that's just some disposition you always have, right? Where you're like, no matter what happens to you, you just have this robustness of the human spirit that makes you always look at things that way, or can make you always look at things that way. Not saying that everyone always does. Not to say that I always do either, just in general I do. But I think too, by pursuing this, whatever this meaning is, and it emerges for each of us, it manifests in its own unique way, I do think for certain you're going to do your best work, because you're just doing what, like when I wake up to read, write, and talk about Bitcoin, it's not work. Kidding me? I'd be doing it anyways. I'd be doing it if no one was listening. So it's fulfilling. It's the question I used to like to ask myself is, and this is way before I ever had any money, is if money were no object, what would you do every day? Like very specifically, money was no object. You can have anything you want. How do you spend your every minute of your day, your average 24-hour day? Like get real detailed about it. Where do you wake up? What are the sheets like? What are you brushing your teeth? What are you doing in the morning? What's your ritual? What are you having for breakfast? Da, 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 whole thing. And actually, I got that from a written exercise that certain university professor was making her students do, was you write your birthday 10 years in advance. You write that super detailed 24-hour depiction of that. And then she did that with students for like 30 years. And she said it never ceased to amaze her how many students would email her later on, like write her letters saying, holy shit, that thing was magic. Like my life hasn't played out exactly like that, but I influenced the course of my life by imagining what it would be. And again, that Jungian principle of circumambulation. It's like you plant the seed and then somehow you start navigating towards it, start closing the gaps from present and future. So it helps you do your best work, which is good for you because you feel good about what you're doing. And hopefully if you're good at what you do, good for everyone. So I think it can be a painful strategy, but I couldn't imagine doing anything else. And as far as how Bitcoin relates to that, like clearly Bitcoin doesn't need to be your meaningful work. Your meaningful work can be anything. Anything is meaningful to you. But I think Bitcoin is just this money that's purpose-built to empower entrepreneurs, right? Like it gives you maximal power and sovereignty, but also comes at the demand of maximum responsibility. And I would like to think that's how it's instilling meaning in people's life, just giving them maybe the freedom and courage or encouragement they need to pursue meaning for themselves. And I went into depth on this in my latest piece, Bitcoin is Hope. Where I said entrepreneurs are problematic to problems. Therefore, they are our best hope. Like we're all here to solve problems. Bureaucrats don't solve problems. No bureaucrat, no politician, no top-down authority has ever solved a single problem in the history of humanity that a free market actor did not execute, right? Maybe it forced someone to do it, but someone accepted their will and went and did it. So it was still an act of volition. And my point is that decree is not going to solve any of our problems. Entrepreneurs solve our problems. And Bitcoin is entrepreneurial money.
I think that's an excellent place to cap things off. Robert, thank you so much for coming with us, coming here and, you know, spending a full almost 2.5 hours here just extrapolating some of your most recent and deepest thoughts and sharing your meaningful experience of this world and your reflection on this crazy thing called Bitcoin, and you know, going on this cosmic deep dive with us. This has been rad, so thank you.
Yeah, man, rad indeed. Thank you for having me, John.
All right, thank you all for attending as well, for everyone who's made it up to this point. And until next time, may you live a meaningful life and enjoy your freedom as a sovereign individual.
Mm-hmm.